It is Tuesday, October 18th, 2011. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Ozarks at Large and KUAF, supported by Collier Drugstores, offering a prescription refill hotline and local delivery from one of Collier's 7 locations, now including Bentonville. Most insurance plans are accepted, and information can be found on the web at collierdrug.com.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, an autumn morning spent with tractors, engines, and the sounds they make. We'll have a report from the annual Tired Iron of the Ozarks Fall Show.
Plus, Wayne Bell from the FayettevilleFlyer.com considers what it takes to have a comeback. And we'll have a preview of this weekend's Art in the Park.
And bloggers Michael Cook and Jason Tolbert discuss the hurdles Democratic candidates might have in 2012 when seeking congressional offices from Arkansas.
First, the Fayetteville Women's Clinic on College Avenue in Fayetteville closed a year ago, shortly before the death of physician Dr. William Harrison. He was one of two surgical abortion providers in Arkansas. His office was often the target of sometimes wrenching pro-life demonstrations. But a new national pacifist group called 40 Days for Life is keeping a vigil at Planned Parenthood in Fayetteville. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports on them, as well as a recent abortion bill newly passed by the U.S. House of Representatives.
Mid-afternoon weekday traffic is busy on Crossover Road between Fayetteville and Springdale. And at the intersection just south of East Joyce Boulevard, all this month people are holding signs and praying, including Ray and Natalie Hines.
You know and you love all the people that work and visit this clinic, that you have purposes that you would, that you desire to bring forth in their lives. You love the woman that's coming here in a crisis pregnancy.
They are part of a 40 Days for Life vigil, which began September 28th and continues through November 6th, now in its fifth year here in Northwest Arkansas. Another group is in Little Rock, protesting at the state's only surgical abortion clinic. 40 Days for Life, established 7 years ago in College Station, Texas, brands itself as nonviolent, with 300 organized vigils worldwide. Founders claim the campaign has prevented 4,300 abortions, closed 16 abortion facilities, and convinced 53 abortion workers to walk off the job.
And also, Lord, I just pray that you would open our eyes to be able to see and understand something of the difficulties that the people that are coming to this clinic are facing, that we can have real compassion. And not
it's impossible to confirm those statistics, but these campaigners are persistent, rain, shine, or lawn sprinklers. Several weeks ago, a local property owner purposely turned the irrigation system on to deter them. But these peaceful protesters don't complain or reciprocate, says Ray Hines. He's taking the late afternoon shift with his wife, Natalie.
We both are self-employed. We have a small sheet metal business in Siloam Springs area. And what was the last question?
What is your religious affiliation?
Oh, religious. Okay. And we're non-denominational.
Yeah. Honking, of course, indicates support by drivers passing by.
Yes. This is costly. This is during our work day. But this is also our time in history that we were born in. And it's a time when right now it's legal to kill a child that is unborn for any reason whatsoever. We believe that's wrong. And we're here, particularly for this vigil, to pray, to appeal to God, to change the situation as he already wants to.
40 Days for Life has 400 members in Northwest Arkansas, with 50 taking turns here. All must sign a statement of peace and nonviolence. The kickoff event in late September had over 100 people, with keynote speakers former State Senator Jim Holt and former State Representative Jim Bob Duggar. He's the reality show star with 19 kids. Ray and Natalie Hines, who have no children, look forward to adopting a child in state custody. And adoption is something they encourage pregnant women seeking abortions to consider, says Natalie Hines.
Well, there's many maternity homes for women to stay. And there's women's shelters. And in Fayetteville, Rogers, and Springdale and Fort Smith. And there's pregnancy help centers. There's one in Fayetteville and Rogers, and one in Siloam Springs.
Locally, organizers say they have no record of how many abortions they've prevented. But some women have turned away from the clinic after seeing the vigil, they say, and also contacted them saying they changed their minds. It's easier to convince people here on the right-of-way at the entrance of Planned Parenthood. The other protest site was the now-shuttered clinic operated by abortion provider Dr. William Harrison on College Avenue. Protesters there had to stand across the highway. Over his 30-year career, Dr. Harrison was the target of death threats, his clinic firebombed and vandalized. Nationwide, at least 8 have died, doctors, clinic workers, and escorts. Anti-abortion extremists display large posters of aborted fetuses and scream at women walking into clinics in an attempt to distract and even shame them. But Ray Hine says this vigil uses a different tactic.
There used to be a time when the whole rhetoric was angry, it was finger-pointing, it was accusative, it was to cast shame upon women that were in this crisis situation trying to make a choice. We believe there's an opportunity to persuade. So I think in our presence and in our demeanor, our desire is to be peaceful, prayerful. It is a prayer vigil. This is not a protest.
Planned Parenthood declined comment for this story, but this clinic does dispense RU-487 or medication abortions. Natalie Hine says the effects may be frightening.
Hemorrhaging. They actually can see the form of their baby when they're at home alone when the baby is expelled.
RU-487 and oral medications not prescribed if a woman is more than 9 weeks pregnant. Bleeding and cramping are normal and may last up to 2 weeks. Severe bleeding, pain, nausea, headache, and vomiting can also occur. Before abortions were legalized in 1973, women sought black market abortions. Some providers were skilled and dedicated, but others did it for the money. In the 1960s, an abortion cost on average $1,000, equal to $7,000 today. Often conditions were not sterile and no anesthesia provided because it took too long for women to recover. Untold thousands of women died from blood loss or infection. In 1977, Medicaid-funded abortion ended under the Hyde Amendment, but 17 states, either through enacted legislation or court order, still provided funding. The remaining states must follow federal law and terminate a pregnancy in cases of life endangerment, rape, or incest. But pro-life advocates are making political headway. On October 13th, the U.S. House passed H.R. 358, the Protect Life Act, that would release hospitals from the legal responsibility of providing a life-saving abortion procedure to a pregnant woman whose life is at risk. Erin Mattson is Action Vice President of the National Organization for Women, which lobbies to secure abortion and reproductive rights, among many other things. She observed the H.R. 358 hearing and heard certain GOP leaders say this ban on abortion was much more important than pursuing a jobs bill.
And instead voted to allow hospitals to let pregnant women die, which was one provision of H.R. 358, to give hospitals total refusal. In essence, as Representative Gwen Moore of Wisconsin said, making it Russian roulette every time a pregnant woman enters a hospital.
Plus, the measure would deny federal funding to health insurance exchanges that cover abortion under the new health care law.
So if you think about things like faith-based initiatives, and we've got a lot of money going to religious charities, the government has found a way to segregate funds there and has with abortion coverage for 35 years at this point. And so it's really just an attempt to make private insurance companies drop coverage altogether.
H.R. 358 will likely die in the U.S. Senate, but if it were to pass, the White House issued a statement saying it would veto the bill. Nearly half of all pregnancies in the United States are not planned. As a consequence, 4 in 10 are terminated by abortion. Nationwide, an estimated 1,700 abortion providers continue to operate. Most are listed in the Yellow Pages, but otherwise don't advertise. But some, like Dr. William Harrison, who provided 20,000 abortions over 3 decades, described protesters as free advertising, drawing women in need to his clinic. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The 40 Days for Life campaign will operate through November 6th. To learn more, visit 40daysforlife.com/Fayetteville. President Barack Obama has never been a popular political figure in Arkansas. In the state, he earned less than 40% of the vote in his 2008 victory. In the most recent Talk Business Hendricks College poll, Obama only scored a 31% job approval rating from Arkansas voters. 63% disapproved, and that begins the speculation in modern-day politics known as the drag on the ticket. Will the president's low numbers be enough to rub off on down-ballot races, such as recently announced Democrats Clark Hall in the 1st Congressional District or State Senator Gene Jeffress in the 4th? Will Obama's low standing aid Republican candidates in those races or even in state legislative elections? Roby Brock from TalkBusiness.net poses these questions to political bloggers Jason Tolbert, who argues often from the Republican perspective, and Michael Cook, who typically sides with the Democrats.
Barack Obama is not popular in Arkansas. He lost it by just about 20 points in 2008. He's going to lose it again in 2012, no doubt about it, whoever it is, whether it be Rick Perry or Mitt Romney. What's interesting, he will be a bit of a problem to some of the federal candidates because they have to, you know, it's a federal race and a national election, and the Republicans are going to try to make it a national election. But if the Democratic candidate can focus on and fight to keep the agenda just on local issues and not what's happening in D.C., they have a chance. And as we talked about a minute ago, these congressional numbers for Rick Crawford and Tim Griffin and the open numbers for the 4th District, these races are very winnable races for the Democratic candidates. They just have to make sure that it's not a national race, and they have to fight tooth and nail because that's, you know, the Republican playbook. It's interesting, Democrats in this race already have the Republican playbook. It's like playing the opposing football team, and the day before the big game, you have their entire binder full of all their plays. So Democrats already know what's coming. The trick that they have to figure out is how do they, you know, negate the negatives of Barack Obama on the ballot and make sure that the election is on things that matter to Arkansans in terms of who has the plan to bring jobs to the community, who's out there fighting for the Arkansas's working and middle class. Those are the issues that are going to be important in the 2012 election.
Sure. And I know that if I was a Democrat in the state, I would certainly be hoping that you're right. You know, I used to play football in high school for Coach Campbell, and he would run the 23 trap almost every play. 3 out of 4 plays, he'd run that play. And the other team knew he was going to run that play, but they still couldn't stop it. We would still get positive yardage on that play almost every time because it worked. I think you're right. I think the Republicans will be trying to focus on the nationalization of this race. They're going to be tying the Democratic candidates to Barack Obama. I think it's going to work. I think he's that unpopular in the state. If you drill down in some of the numbers in our poll, you look at some of the state legislative races. Among those who disapproved of Obama, which is 2/3 of the state, of that group, they were 6 times more likely to vote for the Republican candidate. They were preferred 6-1. The Republican candidate was preferred 6-1 in these state legislative races. Those are very difficult numbers to overcome, and that's going to be hard for them to work against. You saw among independents, the group of independents, they preferred the Republican candidate in these state legislative races by a 3-1 margin. And so when you have that large of an advantage among independents, you have that large of an advantage among 2/3 of the state that opposes Barack Obama, that's really going to create a dynamic for Republicans for, in my opinion, the first time in history, they're going to go into it with a generic advantage. Now, I do agree with you, it's going to come down to the candidates. And if Republicans don't go out and recruit good, solid candidates that are well-known and well-respected in their community, they're known as common-sense conservatives, then they will have a difficult time. You know, they got to have a good candidate to run those races. But if they do a good job with that, and they provide them with the adequate resources, the funds they need to run a campaign, then Democrats are really going to have an uphill battle.
Well, you know, you're talking about legislative races, and that's slightly different than Obama's popularity and the concept of, you know, it's kind of hard to, you know, somebody who's been in the community for their entire life running for state rep or state senate, it's harder to tie them to Barack Obama when it's when people know who the guy or gal is who's running for office. It's like, well, I've been a school principal in this district for 20 years. You know who I am. I've never met Barack Obama. So it makes it a lot tougher, which means it always does come down to candidates. And yes, right now the Republicans do have a generic lead, and the word is generic in terms of when you say a generic Democrat versus a generic Republican. On a statewide level, it's about 6 points. Once you go down to the districts, excluding the third, it goes down to about a 3 or 4 point level. So it's not a massive lead, but a lead nonetheless. The biggest thing is that the people are still undecided when it comes down to the generic ballot. And legislative Democrats, while we're not together yet on the congressional level, there are some really great candidates on the Democratic side who are out there already announced or planning to announce to fight for control of the House and the Senate. I think this time, and as I've talked about in my blog, cooksoutlook.com, and you know, you have 12bellreport.com, you know, I've talked about how last time in 2010, Democrats, unfortunately, didn't have their act together. They weren't very organized when it came to fighting for legislative candidates. Hopefully this time they'll have seen their mistakes of things they could have done better and fixed them, and then headed to 2012 with a well-organized, well-funded effort to hold on to this the General Assembly.
I think you're right. I think that the advantage Republicans had last time, almost being a surprise attack, Democrats didn't see coming. I think they won some races that they may not have won if the Democrats had picked up and keyed in that was happening. Of course, the advantage for Republicans this time, I think during candidate recruitment, that's going to help them. Last time, I don't think that it had fully been picked up on around the state that the Republicans had that advantage. And so when someone who was the school teacher in their community was thinking about running for the state legislature, they may have been trying to decide which party to run in, and they may have chosen the Democratic Party, even though they were a conservative, because they felt like that party had the advantage. That same person this time around may choose to run as a Republican, especially if they're a conservative to begin with.
You can hear more from the discussion between bloggers Michael Cook and Jason Tolbert about Arkansas politics online at talkbusiness.net. Support for content from talkbusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at mitchellwilliamslaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at bankozarks.com. And Verizon, offering small business solutions, including high-speed mobile broadband, wireless email, global services, and push-to-talk. More information at a Verizon communication store or online at vzw.com/small business.
Earth, sky. A University of Alberta research team has turned up a treasure trove of feathers trapped in ancient tree resin or amber.
They say the fossilized feathers appear to be from a mix of birds and non-flying dinosaurs. They say the feather specimens are between 78 and 79 million years old.
Graduate student and lead author Ryan McKellar said his team discovered the feathers trapped in amber among amateur amber collections and among the large amber collections at the Royal Tyrrell Museum in southern Alberta, Canada. The museum's collection comes from Canada's most famous amber deposit near Grassy Lake in southwestern Alberta.
No dinosaur or avian fossils were found with the amber feather specimens, but McKellar said a comparison between the amber and fossilized feathers found in rock strongly suggests that some of the specimens in the Grassy Lake amber are from non-flying dinosaurs. Most scientists believe that modern birds evolved from theropod dinosaurs, so this is further evidence.
In the same amber, the scientists also found extremely well-preserved feathers of ancient birds, preserved down to their color and microscopic structure. The paper's authors say this discovery shows that feathers served a range of functions in both dinosaurs and birds. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And Antoinette, I want you to listen to something.
Okay.
And see if you can identify what's making the sound. Any idea?
Not really. It's a kind of an odd rhythm, but maybe, I don't know, maybe it's connected to a belt or something, because it does have a consistency to it.
It is connected to a belt. Very good. Ah. Very good. That is a Rock Island 1-horsepower gasoline engine built in 1917 or so. Engines like this one were used on farms nearly 100 years ago to pump water. That engine belongs to Dave Hackett of Cape Fear, Missouri, and he was letting it run, pop, and sizzle at the Tired Iron of the Ozarks Fall Show near Gentry earlier this autumn. He sat in a lawn chair next to this engine and others he was showing, and occasionally tinkered with one of them.
Oh, I've enjoyed them for many years and finally got around to getting one and restoring it. They're a lot of fun.
The Tired Iron of the Ozarks Club has shows each year in the spring and the fall. The people showing off their engines at the Tired Iron grounds are mostly, but not exclusively, men. All of them eager to show off the metal they've collected.
I'm the biggest known Leroy engine collector in the world.
Ed stands in the middle of the midway, several machines on a flat trailer behind him, all of them sporting Leroy engines. He says the company began making engines for all kinds of contraptions in 1914, many of them exported to Australia and New Zealand. When a company owner died on the Titanic, the company was forced to reconfigure, and one of the first engine models it built during this era sits just behind Ed.
This is a 1922 ice saw. It's for cutting ice out of the lakes and rivers. And I have two of them, a 1922 and a 23 that I bought up in Iowa.
One of the perks of visiting a Tired Iron show is to become acquainted with chores and jobs, like harvesting ice with an ice saw, that have evaporated over time. The huge saw and trailer would be placed on ice, and with a total weight of around 2,200 pounds, that wouldn't be thin ice, and drill down and cut out 22-inch by 34-inch blocks of ice. Those blocks would be shipped around the world. Ice saws, in fact, ice harvesting, would no longer be needed once ice machines were invented in the 1930s and 40s. So Ed Malcolm scoops up any Leroy engines he finds, whether in a barn in Iowa or on eBay. In fact, he says he collects almost anything to do with a defunct company. Books, manuals, anything.
I've got 150 original advertisements from 1917 to 1954. Those advertisements have answered tons of questions, because they were bought out in 1956. And the company that bought them out, the first thing they wanted to get rid of their competition. The first thing they did was destroyed every bit of the company records. So I have more of that. And I had a woman call me a while back from out east, and she said her husband had bought one of these engines, a Leroy. And she said, he put me on the internet trying to see what I could find. And she said, everywhere I go on the internet for Leroy engines, you keep coming up.
While not everybody at the show has as specific a collection as Ed, almost everybody does tend to gravitate toward one kind of engine or another.
This is an oil field engine. Come out of north central Oklahoma.
Lynn from Winslow spent much of the Saturday morning portion of the show trying to keep an old oil field engine running properly. He says it was made in 1922 or 23. It's a huge mass of pipes and steel, and it once powered six oil wells in Drumright, Oklahoma. Lynn, in between tweaking the parts on the engine, explains he's fascinated with oil field machinery.
Just the fact that they're, you know, 90, 95 years old and still running. And of days gone by, you know, just the way people used to do things. I grew up in South Arkansas in the oil field, so it was a fascination when I was growing up, and it's still a fascination to see them run. But this will weigh 5,000 pounds sitting here.
One of the bonds that these hobbyists have in common is the sheer respect for machines built nearly a century ago but still run with a bit of work and some grease. Almost to a person, it will be pointed out that most of the machines or engines built today will be lucky to last half as long as these. Though Lynn admits it's sometimes even better if a stubborn 90-year-old engine needs plenty of work.
We worked on this engine I guess for 2 years getting it unstuck because it just, you know, set out in the weather with the oilers off of it, and it was rusted from one end to the other. But there was about six or eight of us. We didn't work on it every day or every week, but off and on for about 2 years to get it freed up and get it running.
What's that like when it finally goes that first time?
Well, like anything, you know, when you work like an automobile or anything, or I'm sure a carpenter, when he finishes that project and he finally gets it through and polishes it down and steps back and look at it, you know, you get that sense of satisfaction, and if you got somebody working with you, the camaraderie that goes with it.
I guess you get used to that.
The biggest engines at the Fall Tired Iron Weekend were attached to tractors. One of the most interesting, owned by Rod Hady of Springdale. He revved the motor from his seat, which was about 10 feet off the ground. It's a tractor that dates back to the Eisenhower administration and the creation of the interstate system. This tractor replaced common bulldozers that had been used to pull scrapers to remove dirt as a road was built.
But a bulldozer only runs about 5 miles an hour. Well, if they had these long hauls, they'd scrape the dirt and have to go a mile or two to dump it. Just couldn't get it done. So several companies, Caterpillar being one of them, designed high-speed tractors to pull the scrapers. When they loaded, they would push them with bulldozers. This didn't have enough power to load itself. But once it got loaded, it would run nearly 30 miles an hour. They'd haul it wherever they needed to go, and it had enough power it could unload, and then it could run back empty, so it was a huge increase in productivity.
Rod says he's been collecting vintage tractors only a few years. He has two at this show and another at home in the garage. He found this one in Hebron, Nebraska.
If a little kid comes up, they've never seen this. They've never heard one run. So I always make sure they get to go for a ride, and I make sure I start it for them.
Even though the engines collected by members of the Tired Iron of the Ozarks are older and thus fewer, membership in the club seems to be growing. Many showing their wares this fall say this was the biggest show the group has had. And there is always a bit of recruiting going on. People telling you how much fun it is to maintain a decades-old engine, and they say how easy.
Keep them oiled, keep them greased, and it'll keep running.
You can learn more at TiredIronOfTheOzarks.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Before the recession, Arkansas highway officials began discussing the construction of a limited-access eastern bypass that would extend from South Fayetteville to north of Rogers. That plan was scrapped. Instead, the Arkansas Highway and Transportation Department commissioned a feasibility study to extend Highway 265 from Springdale, where it terminates north of town, to U.S. 62, which runs east-west north of Rogers. Planners say computer modeling indicates the project is justified. So now highway officials are holding two public meetings to collect comments on their study in both Springdale and Rogers this week. John McLarty, Transportation Study Director for the Northwest Arkansas Regional Planning Commission, says there are three possible routes, and seeking public opinion on what might work best is the next step.
You know, the first thing the highway department does is just, is this facility needed? And then, so this isn't a location meeting to pin down the route, but it is to show, you know, that some corridors have been identified, but it's not to the stage of picking the exact route yet. So it's still in the arena of is the facility needed? What are some of the issues that might be out there?
Highway 265, a three-lane center turn highway in East Fayetteville, becomes four lanes into Springdale before it terminates. Three routes to extend it are being considered, following Old Wire Road north, build slightly west of Old Wire, following portions of First Street and Rogers through the Cross Hollow area, and the final option, build a route farther east away from the city. Planners say the Cross Hollow area is archaeologically sensitive, so that could present barriers. But overall, computer modeling indicates the new corridor will ease congestion both on Interstate 540 and US 71B.
I just looked at the figures on our model, and it shows that this route, if completed, would carry just about as much traffic as 71B does. You know, it would be to the east of 71B. But it's showing in the year 2035 that it would have traffic counts up around 35,000, which is very attractive.
The Arkansas Highway and Transportation Department are hosting two public input sessions today from 4 to 7 at the Jones Center in Springdale and Wednesday from 4 to 7 at Rogers Heritage High School.
Work is continuing on a pedestrian tunnel that will be part of Fayetteville's alternative trails and transportation system. The tunnel requires excavation across Garland Avenue near Agri Park. Traffic for much of this week and next near the work will be rerouted off of Garland and through Agri Park. When completed, the tunnel will connect the Skull Creek Trail to the west side of Interstate 540.
GOP presidential candidate Herman Cain will be in Northwest Arkansas later this month. He's scheduled to address the Lincoln Day Dinner in Springdale October 27th. The chair of the Washington County Republican Party, Jim Rivas, says the candidate's upcoming appearance has created a stir.
It is just amazing that the phone calls that we're getting and who have bought tickets to this have actually gone so far over the political spectrum, and so far across the state. We've got people from Missouri, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Tennessee, who are driving in to listen to this man.
Herman Cain has emerged in recent weeks as a strong challenger to Mitt Romney for the party nomination.
Senior Jasmine Norton is the SEC Volleyball Player of the Week, following strong performances at home last weekend. This is Norton's first conference recognition since earning six Freshman of the Week accolades in 2009. It's the Arkansas Razorbacks' first Player of the Week since former Razorback standout Jessica Durrell was honored twice in 2007. Arkansas, by the way, will be at Barnhill Arena twice this weekend, hosting Mississippi Friday night and Alabama Sunday afternoon.
The Arkansas football game against Vanderbilt a week from Saturday will kick off at 11:21 a.m. and be broadcast on the SEC Network. Start time for the game in Nashville was announced yesterday.
Support for Ozarks at Large and KUAF is provided in part by Walton Arts Center and its 20th anniversary season, presenting the Munich Symphony performing Mozart's Requiem on Tuesday, November 1st. Tickets or more information are available at waltonartscenter.org or 443-5600. It is Tuesday, October 18th, 2011. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Amy Spencer-Hayda.
With us is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is about the time that, as I do every month, midway through the month, I say it's what date?
I know.
Yeah. Holy cow! The crafts fairs are already over.
More than halfway through October.
The snow's coming any minute. I know. But coming before the snow is Don Williams.
One of the best voices in country music history.
And he is at the Alma Performing Arts Center tonight. Hmm. I was at the Alma Performing Arts Center for my first visit a week or so ago for trout fishing in America. What a beautiful facility that is. Oh, my gosh.
So Don Williams is there tonight.
7:30. Tickets start at $30, and you can find out more at 632-2129.
If you've never heard the song, I believe in You, Don Williams. You haven't lived yet.
Tulsa Time.
Fantastic voice.
Also tonight, if you're in that area and you can somehow clone yourself and be two places,
there's a
fall concert featuring the University Chorale, Women's Chorus, and the Jazz Cats at 7:30 at Arkansas Best Performing Arts Center in Fort Smith, and that's only $6.
What time is that?
It starts at 7:30.
Oh, well, you can't be both.
Well, maybe some people can.
Like, okay.
They might be cooler than we are.
Right.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
150 years ago, officials seeking supplies for Arkansas's Confederate troops in a state with limited industrial capacity turned to a rather unusual source. The state contracted with A.J. Ward, who ran the Arkansas State Penitentiary, to manufacture materials that would be paid for with war bonds. The 120 convicts in the prison, located where the Arkansas State Capitol now stands, were soon producing wagons, harness, tents, cartridge boxes, belts, caissons, knapsacks, boots, and shoes. An October 15, 1861 inspector's report showed the prison expanding its shops and cell blocks, but found the cells damp and poorly ventilated, noting that there was no covering of any kind on the ground floor of the building. To learn more about Arkansas history and the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War, visit ArkansasCivilWar150.com. The Arkansas Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission is an agency of the Department of Arkansas Heritage I'm Mark Christ.
Wilson Park in Fayetteville offers a number of amenities such as a softball field, swimming pool, tennis courts, and a castle. On Saturday, it will also offer local residents the opportunity to view art during the annual Art in the Park event. Kent Landrum is the chairman of this year's event, which has been around for nearly a decade.
It started 8 years ago with a group of painters who wanted to share their paintings with the community, and they were painting outdoors. So they thought, well, let's paint at the park, and worked it out with the, I think the first one happened at Gully Park, maybe the first couple. And then after 1 year, they changed to Wilson Park, and it's been there ever since. So it's a good way to get outdoors in the fall on a pretty day and paint. So there will be artists demonstrating painting and drawing during the event.
The event is organized by the Fayetteville Parks and Recreation Department, who will provide some food, and the Artists of Northwest Arkansas, who will provide the art. Landrum says he anticipates more than 40 artists will be on hand this weekend to create works of art using oils, watercolor, pastels, and acrylics. He says visitors are more than welcome to talk to the artists while they work.
We encourage you to bother them, and they'll be happy to stop what they're doing and talk to you about their work. Everybody, I think, will have some other work that's finished. So what they're working on is they may be able to finish it there and they may not, but you can watch their progress.
Artists will also have some of their work for sale at the event. Landrum, an oil painter who has participated in Art in the Park in the past, says he plans to display some of his paintings of the Fayetteville Farmers Market. This past weekend, he participated in a plein air event where he was one of about 100 artists who painted outside. He says he enjoys creating art outdoors because of the difficulties it poses.
It's very much of a challenge, and I like the challenge. But I also just like to be out, and it's a good way to enjoy the day. Plus, when I'm looking at something that I'm painting, I look more closely. So I like that too. Kind of encourages me to take a closer look at the world.
Children who attend this year's Art in the Park will be able to have a hands-on experience. Volunteers from the Artists of Northwest Arkansas will help kids create paper collages and paint. Although volunteers will be on hand, Landrum requests that children younger than 14 years old are accompanied by a parent. By hosting this public event, Landrum says it gives members of the nonprofit an opportunity to meet the community.
And that's our, you know, part of our support system and patronage. So we're happy to do that and you know, have a an event for the community that's fun for everybody. And so there's what we like about it is the action, you know, with the painters actually doing their craft and the children getting to participate too. So that's our purpose, and I hope we keep doing it for a long time.
Art in the Park is scheduled for 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday at Wilson Park in Fayetteville. Participating artists must be current members of ANA, and they can register for the event on Saturday morning. Landrum says there is no rain date, so the event will happen rain or shine. Fayetteville Parks and Recreation Department will be providing a limited number of free hot dogs. More information is available at artistsnwarkansas.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy news studio, back on his regular day now. Tuesdays is Wayne Bell. Wayne writes the column Culture Club for FayettevilleFlyer.com. Welcome back.
Thanks a lot.
And speaking of coming back to Tuesday, we're going to talk about great comebacks in our conversation today.
Do you have a definition for a comeback?
I think a comeback would be someone who either commercially or artistically, I mean, if we're talking in the entertainment world, has been at some point regarded as irrelevant and then comes back to produce work that is relevant in some way. Written off and then back. When I think of comebacks, the one that, and I don't know why this is the one that hits me is Jerry Lewis. You know, he had been a box office success in the 50s and 60s, first with Dean Martin, then on his own. But his movies continued to get worse and worse. And other than the Labor Day telethon, you really didn't see him much until Martin Scorsese put him in a movie opposite Robert De Niro.
Right. And that's kind of the key I've noticed when I was looking at of great comebacks, whether it be in music or film or television. It's either been a medium change, like Rob Lowe was big in the 80s, and then he had kind of a public fall, and then he's had a medium change, and now he went to the small screen with Brothers and Sisters and Parks and Recreation, West Wing. Or it's been, the same could be said for Glenn Close, you know, with Damages. She went away, then she comes back. Or it's been one great project has brought someone back. And that's been the more consistent way that somebody gets brought back, is they have one great song, one great album, one great movie. And then you have to kind of see from there, do they have staying power?
What about Tony Bennett? I mean, the guy was huge, had his problems with alcoholism, and really kind of almost became this sort of punchline for stand-up comedians, the so hip in the 50s and 60s and so unhip. And then, boom, he was back. He had an Unplugged special on MTV.
Yeah, I mean, that one record of the year a couple of years ago, a decade ago or two decades.
But he's back on top.
Yeah, and 2-3 weeks ago, he had the number one album in the country. So that's a really interesting, you know, way to look at it. I think that there's a couple of people of recent that have had big comebacks, but we don't quite know yet if they have legs. One that definitely had legs, and I think that it worked really well, was John Travolta. I'm not a huge Travolta fan, but what I will say is he was huge, and then he had sort of some B-rate movies. And
Perfect? Do you remember Perfect with Jamie Lee Curtis?
No, I don't. but in his case, it was one movie, Pulp Fiction, and he was able to use the legs off that movie to then, you know, do Primary Colors and Get Shorty and, you know, a lot
Michael
of movies.
Michael had a bunch.
Yeah, he had a lot of movies and, you know, even Hairspray and stuff like that. So he was able to use that one movie to really catapult him. But then there's others that, you know, they've had that one great movie and then we're just still waiting to see. Like, for instance, Burt Reynolds, if you remember.
Right.
He was so big in the 70s and early 80s.
I think for 4 or 5 years, he was the number one,
box office draw. And then went away and went to nowhere. And then he sort of had a small comeback with Evening Shade, and then he went away again. And then he had a big comeback with Boogie Nights and was up for an Oscar and all that. And then just kind of it didn't surface, it didn't go anywhere. The same could be said for Kim Basinger, big in the 80s, huge, you know, Batman and all that, and 9.5 weeks, and and then she went through some real public disputes with Land, and I think she went bankrupt, and then had one great movie, L.A. Confidential, won an Oscar, and you thought, wow, where did that come from? And then we don't see her anymore, and that's happened of recent too. You know, you look at Mickey Rourke,
and The Wrestler.
Yeah, has that one big part, and now we're kind of, you know, he said a few things since then, but we are kind of waiting to see if you know, if he can really capitalize on that.
The actor Thomas Hayden Church,
yeah,
who was one. He wasn't one of the leads in the sitcom Wings, but. And then he kind of went away, and then sideways, and his star had risen again.
Yeah, and he's been able to work on that. You know, I think that he's done some television projects since then. And, you know, it's kind of like every time Marissa Tomei does a really great movie, they say she's had a great comeback. Well, it's like, where did she go? Because she she's a working actress who's done great work, and every constantly. 4 or 5 years she gets an Oscar nomination. So that's not what I would call a comeback. You know, if Mickey Rourke is able to capitalize on that wrestler momentum and really, you know, move forward with it, then that's a true comeback.
I also think of Charlie Chaplin, because of course he was perhaps the most famous person in the world in the 1920s, and he was one of the last people to move into the talking movie industry. He also became politically unpopular during the Red Scare, but then he came back towards the end of his career and made some amazing movies, mm-hmm. and again became critically important.
Yeah, I think that's definitely someone that, you know, is kind of a model, and he's also somebody who finally had to learn, I'm going to adapt.
Mm-hmm. Who would you like? Is there anyone you'd like to see have a comeback? Because I've got someone I'm thinking of.
Well, I was on this bandwagon a few years ago that I really wanted Whitney Houston to have a comeback, because I thought nobody beats that voice when it was in its prime. But then I quickly learned that she doesn't have it anymore, mm-hmm. you know, and she had kind of destroyed it. Between age and then some of her extracurricular activities.
Right.
And so I don't think she could handle a comeback. As far as people I'd like to see come back, you know, I think that there's some people that, well, like Glenn Close is a good example, where they were on the radar for a long period of time and then they just kind of went away and they've come back kind of, but we've yet to see them fully, you know, come back. What about you?
M. Night Shyamalan. I thought The Sixth Sense was a great movie, and I liked the couple he had after that, including Unbreakable. But the last several mm-hmm. have neither attracted audiences nor positive reviews, and I would really like to see him make another movie, not necessarily like Sixth Sense, but innovative and surprising.
Well, that's just it. I think his problem was he was touched by the Oscar buzz, where, you know, you have these people who, you know, do really well. They're either nominated or they win for their first big movie. And then they feel like for every movie after that, they have to do the same pattern over and over and over. And that typically doesn't lead to success. You've got to reinvent yourself over and over.
Can an entertainment property have a comeback? It seems like Saturday Night Live, which is now in, I don't know, its 36th, 37th year on television, has had several.
Yeah.
Where it has been written off and perhaps near cancellation. And
well,
then,
just like that one song or that one movie can bring somebody back, Saturday Night Live can have one, you know, Will Ferrell or one
Eddie Murphy
or one Tina Fey that can bring it back and make it relevant again. The problem is that as you get older and older and older, it becomes harder and harder and harder to bounce back. And you know, with Saturday Night Live, with all the different competition that it now has, it's certainly going to be more and more difficult for them to mount the kind of comeback that they need to make. But, you know, they still have Kristen Wiig and they still have talented properties.
All right. And you'll come back next week.
I sure will.
Wayne Bell writes the column Culture Club for FayettevilleFlyer.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 18th of October, 2011. It's the birthday of Ontazake Shange, born Paulette Williams in Trenton, New Jersey, 1948, author of the play For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide, When the Rainbow Is Enough. Her most recent book, the novel Some Sing, Some Cry. It's the birthday of Christina Enrique, born in Delaware, 1977, came from a Panamanian family. Most recent novel, The World in Half. It's the birthday of Abbott Joseph Liebling, A.J. Liebling, New York City, 1904, staff writer for The New Yorker for many years, wrote about food, journalism, boxing, covered World War II, wrote about the day-to-day life among the soldiers and civilians. He later wrote of the war years, "The times were full of certainties. We could be certain we were right, and we were. And that certainty made us certain that anything we did was right, too. I have seldom been sure I was right since. I know that it is socially acceptable to write about war as an unmitigated horror, but subjectively, at least, it was not true. And you can feel its pull on men's memories at the maudlin reunions of war divisions. They mourn for their dead, but also for war. It's the birthday of the playwright Wendy Wasserstein, born Brooklyn, 1950, devoted herself to theater instead of family life. So she wrote a play about it, The Heidi Chronicles, 1988, about a woman who's clung to all her feminist ideals while all of her friends have given them up and gone on to have children. Wendy Wasserstein, who said, "The marriages come and go, but your friendships stay, which is the opposite of what it used to be, so that there will be people in our lives for 30 years, and often it is not your husband, it's your women friends, male friends, with whom you come of age." It's the birthday of the novelist Rick Moody, New York City, 1961, grew up in the Connecticut suburbs, whose passion for writing was ignited by reading Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea in the sixth grade. He said, "I probably liked the Hemingway novel because I was very interested in sharks." His first novel was Garden State, came out in 1992, of which the author said, "I think it's a truly dreadful book, but it's emotionally accessible and vulnerable, and I admire that." Most recent book, The Four Fingers of Death. Here's a poem for today by Joyce Sutphen, from Out the Cave. When you have been at war with yourself for so many years that you have forgotten why, when you have been driving for hours and only gradually begin to realize that you have lost the way, when you have cut hastily into the fabric, when you have signed papers in distraction, when it has been centuries since you watched the sunset or the rainfall, and the clouds drifting overhead pass as flat as anything on a postcard, when, in the midst of these everyday nightmares, you understand that you could wake up, you could turn and go back to the last thing you remember doing with your whole heart. That passionate kiss, the brilliant drop of love rolling along the tongue of a green leaf. Then you wake, you stumble from your cave, blinking in the sun, naming every shadow as it slips." A poem by Joyce Sutphen from Out the Cave, from Straight Out of View, published by Beacon Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by CenturyLink, a new kind of broadband company linking Americans coast to coast with consistently fast speeds and personal service. More at CenturyLink.com. Produced by our technical director, Thomas Scheutzker. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Ozarks at Large and KUAF, supported by White River Nursery, offering full-service landscaping, design, and construction, including outdoor living spaces, fences, patios, and decks. Located on East Huntsville Road in Fayetteville near Lake Sequoia, 442-2061 for more information.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Pindall.
And if Pindall, it's too small to have a high school, but if Pindall could have a high school, their mascot should be...
You're going to say pinball.
No, the Wizards.
Ah.
The Pindall Wizards.
Ah, oh, nice.
Thank you. Let's see. Tomorrow, you and I, back here.
Yes.
A new show, a fundraising version.
Yes.
Fundraiser starts officially tomorrow. You can help us end it. We're trying to get a record short fundraiser, just 3 days.
3 days.
How can they help?
By donating now at KUAF.com.
And that's as simple as that. Thank you very much. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Have a fantastic Tuesday.